We welcome into the program writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
How's it going, sir? I hear that they call you now Mr. 2000. Congratulations on your achievement with those many shows.
Well, it's fascinating. We're just mediocre enough to stay under the radar. I think that's the key.
You're fast-tracking it to 3,000. And as you know, 3,000 shows, as with 3,000 hits, assures enshrinement in the Hall of Fame. So, well done.
See, I wonder, though, is that true in the steroid era? Will they hold that against me that I've been using performance enhancers?
I don't know, man. I'm tired, so I'm just like going off the top of my head with my metrics today.
Well, let's talk movies. We want to go back 65 years, even before I was born, to talk about some films from 1954 and inversions. What do you mean by that?
Our theme of inversions today. So, basically, as simple as possible, what's small is big, what's dry is wet. We're talking about things antithetical to our standard expectations with these particular films.
Well, let's start with Mickey Rooney in an interesting role with a great cast, too. Kevin McCarthy, who was in so many great movies in the 50s. Jerry Paris, who would go on to great television success. Drive a Crooked Road. Let's talk about that.
He's cast against type right away here because Mickey Rooney would have been known to Americans at the time as America's child boy darling, the boy next door who had the dimples and was this rogue in some ways, but a harmless rogue, and you didn't mind him going out with your daughter. It would probably be okay, but they would kick up to some hijinks, right? That's what Mickey Rooney was about. He was in these Andy Hardy films, and there were a smattering of them. They were very popular at the time. And in this film, it's a film noir, which is not what you'd expect to find Rooney in. So it's casting him way against type to sort of make him this badass. Like, here's this sweet kid, and now he's going to be like, whoa, this is really intense. Can't believe you're doing this. He gets caught up in this plot to be the getaway driver. This is the gist of the film. This is the concept upon which it hangs. Because he's not a mechanic, and he's really into race car driving. That's what he does as his hobby on the weekends. He goes around and he competes in amateur races for $50, whatever it might be. And he's essentially recruited to be part of this heist. And the bait, as it were, is this girl that he falls for, who is fond of him, but is using him. And Rooney, who is a cute kid, good-looking guy at this time, he's cast as this ugly duckling. He's embarrassed by his physical appearance. Like, he's just someone in high school who is not secure in who he is, and he has a scar, and he's playing against type, and he is going to make this thrilling run across this desert-like landscape.
And was this the first of the dramatic roles for Rooney? Because he had a pretty good stretch through the rest of the 50s and into the 60s of quite often playing those sometimes seedy dramatic types.
He had been de-wholesomed to a degree at this point, but this is the first film where it's really like, okay, let's get some traction here. Let's go for it with this guy. As it was a shock move. It was the type of move where you're like, do you believe this as we're standing here at the water cooler? That Rooney is now this, not that he's in Robert Mitchum territory, right? Not that he's like hard-boiled and everything, because part of the appeal of his character is his naivete, his innocence. And it's a film where he's going to certainly lose his innocence. And a lot of it takes place along the shore, too. And there's this interesting subgenre of noir where you wouldn't think it would work, because we think of noir as urban and it's rained at night and we see the lights reflecting off puddles and everything. But there is this subgenre of seascape noir, and that's what this is. He's on the beach a lot with this really hot woman, and the final climax of the film is Rooney on a beach after a crack up in a car, and I won't spoil it for people, and it's left nebulous at the close, but he might have a tough road different kind of road ahead of him for a, pun, stretch of time.
Also from 1954, the first Godzilla film.
Another inversion, because it's a monster movie, except this time the monster is writ very large. The metrics on Godzilla in the film are, they're like hilarious. He's like 164 meters. He's something crazy, like that no dinosaur ever was. He's a skyscraper. And what you would expect with a large-bodied monster is a film that's a full-throated shout. And we thrill to those moments in those films where the monster gets pissed, and the monster's like, okay, let's do this. It's go time. You rally around that. It's exciting when that carnage is going to come. Godzilla, he's the product of the atomic age. He's irradiation in basilisk form, and get the sense that he doesn't really enjoy the carnage he's about to wreak. It's a quiet, plaintive monster movie. So you have this giant, enormous beast with his atomic breath, and yet there's this spectral quality, a tone to the film that's not dissimilar to what you get with a ghost story.
Mm.
And ghost stories, Japanese ghost stories in cinema and in literature, are very somber. And I like that the idea that here is this monster, he's certainly alive, he's eating trains, and he destroys like an unreal amount of boats and throwback frigates, which I like. And the scientists are always counting the number of boats. Like, oh, we got 17 more. It's like, what do we have here? Is he just moving through the fleet? And yet it's sad. He feels like somebody who doesn't really want to be doing what he's doing, but he's tasked into doing it. Just like this culture, this way of life, is attempting to rebuild itself, and certainly he's not helping, but he doesn't want to really be a part of what's going on either.
Right. If we had just left him alone and let him sleep, everything would have been fine. And then the scientists also are faced with a core weapon that can maybe dispatch with him, but who knows what that will unleash.
The weapon is pretty horrific because it breaks down matter. It makes things choke on their own dissolved form. That's not really probably a great way to go out if you had your druthers.
Oh.
And there were these films at the time, the same year, we have Creature from the Black Lagoon, where you have these ecological parables, these nature horror films. And again, as with Creature from the Black Lagoon, it's that prevailing melancholia. And that's what we get here. It's like, just let the guy sleep. Which really, when you think about it, not like that's some whale tale of a life either. It's just, okay, just leave him alone in his watery crypt. And this whole thing is grim and somber. And it's just like, this is not what you expect from a monster movie. And it's not what Godzilla became with the franchise. People who just know it from Creature Double Feature and whatnot, and he's battling some giant moth from the sky, go back to this one, and it's like, wow, it's the quiet string quartet in the minor key of big, giant monster films.
Also that same year, another one of the atomic bomb-inspired sci-fi films with a great cast, James Whitmore, a young James Arness, Edmund Gwenn, them, is one of my favorites from that time period.
James Arness, he shows up in these films around this time, right? You don't really expect him to. He is, as we've discussed before, our monster carrot in The Thing from Another World. He is not a monster in this one. He is an FBI agent. And the film has just this great opening where we've all experienced the terror of being so deep in horror's maw that we can't use our own mouth speak with any degree of clarity. And the child sees these ants, them. It's just, that's all that's going to come out. And there are jokes throughout, too. They're grim jokes. Like, there's an alcoholic in a drunk tank, right? And nobody believes him. He's talking, alcoholism, funny back then. Nobody believes him about these ants outside his window. And there's a mutilated father, and kids go missing. And it's just very intense. And the inversion here is, oh, ants are annoying. We're at the picnic. These ants, they are something else entirely. They are massive. They have this acid. I like the idea that we know there's an ant problem because of an autopsy early on that registers this acid that you're only going to find with ants for the most part. There are flamethrowers. And again, irradiated bugs, irradiated creatures, this idea of man, a woman, overstepping the bounds, this impregnation of a kind of unnatural order. And order is restored at the end of the film, but it comes with that sort of postscript of what's too far, what's knowledge that goes beyond where we should go, and you get the sense that this is just the start of things that are going to get a lot worse, and next time it won't be ants, it can be something far beyond them.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about the terrific films from 1954 that feature inversions. Let's go a different route this time with, Ebenezer Scrooge himself, Alistair Sim, in An Inspector Calls.
I am, of course, fond of Sim because I'm doing a book coming out next year on the 1951 version of A Christmas Carol, which in England, where this particular film was made, was called Scrooge. And Sim was, for a long time, a comedian. You would have known him as just this master of the Duke of Hilarity. That was his actual nickname. In British pictures. And he did something like Scrooge, which was against type, although it was pretty funny at different points of that film. And this film is not funny. It's a drama. And Sim plays an inspector who does indeed call. He turns up at the home of some rich people. And he says, okay, there's been this suicide. And I need to question all of you. This girl has died, she killed herself, and I need to talk to all of you because I think you're responsible. And everyone has an excuse, and it becomes this grinding, eviscerating social commentary as you get into the story, backstories of these people, where truths come out, and, oh, I could have done this better, and, oh, I did this to this person. Just how rudeness in life, how apathy accrues. And there is a twist at the end that this inspector might not be. It's a big flourish kind of a moment. He might not be whom we think he is because somebody else shows up in his stead. And it's like, oh, actually, I am this such and such. It's like, oh, who'd we let into our house, man? That was really weird. But it's a film that sheds some insight, I think, on how much responsibility we all have for the people around us. How that adds up, how our choice is to not be a person for others impacts lives negatively, and impacts our own lives negatively too.
And finally, a film, as is often the case, that was not really appreciated in its time. It didn't get great reviews. It's since come to be considered a classic, directed by the great Nicholas Ray with a tremendous cast, Joan Crawford, Mercedes McCambridge, Sterling Hayden. Let's talk about Johnny Guitar.
This must have been just over the heads of people, and certainly something that went round the bend of their expectations at the time, because you have this gender bender of a movie, and we talk about things like the gender binary, all of that, which I tend to think is rubbish, but at the time, in the 1950s, gender roles were pretty hardcore. That this was the age of that Leave It to Beaver setup. And that's how it was for a lot of families, but not every family, of course. But in this film, you have Joan Crawford as this very deterministic alpha female. And she runs a saloon, and she has a rival named Vienna, and there is a guy named Danton Kidd who is up to no good throughout the film. He's just problematic for everybody. You shouldn't get involved with anyone who bills themselves as Danton Kidd. And our title character, who's actually Johnny Logan, played by Sterling Hayden of the Square Jaw, comes into town, and he is Joan Crawford's ex. And I like the way that that relationship is handled, because you don't get a lot of that in cinema. You don't get a lot of it, certainly at the cinema of the time, where people who were together, who are no longer together, have still a sort of relationship together. I find that very interesting how that's going to be handled. And it's not like these two rekindle their love. They fight. They have some moments of affection, but we see why they're not together anymore. And yet, they still do the right thing by each other when it's absolutely necessary. So it's an inversion, too, of what often happens after love dissolves. We go our separate ways. We don't wish well for the other person. These people necessarily had to go their separate ways, but they come together in a hard spot, and each is sympathetic to the other and tends to the other's needs, which is kind of touching. And again, something we don't expect in the film. And the cast is just, it's loaded with people. Anytime you get Ward Bond, even though he was like really a prick to Orson Welles, but anytime he's in the film, it's usually going to be good. You get Ernest Borgnine, John Carradine, who is an excellent actor, who just slummed it in a lot of bad roles. Royal Dano, who, if you don't know him, you'd recognize his face because he's in like everything that's ever been on television in the 50s and 60s. Paul Fix, who was Micah Torrance, right, in The Rifleman.
Right.
So a lot of just jam-packed, great actors, character actors, make this film really go.
And I think very similar, some themes that were taken by Clint Eastwood some 40 years later in Unforgiven, of the over-the-top violence that I wonder if in some ways was a commentary on the entire Western film genre from Nicholas Ray.
There's a cartooning to the violence in the film, and I think that's reflected as well in the splashiness of the film's mise-en-scene. It's a very shouty, loud, in-your-face, kind of broad, colored sort of film, and it pops from the screen. It's enveloping. It's in this era of the wide screen, which we take for granted now with our televisions. But a film like this would have been like, whoa, Nicholas Ray, what are you doing? You're just enveloping me in this movie. And there's something about the cartooning of violence that makes it certainly less real. It becomes more of a formula of life, of interaction, to move plot from one way to another. And we're not really attuned to the intensity of that violence, which makes us focus more in on the intensity of the connections, I think, because the violence becomes secondary, but emotional violence, what we can do to each other, moves to the fore. And that, to me, is always more potent than somebody getting shot in the head. Actually, people get shot in the head a lot in this film. But it's just that, to me, is what lasts. That's what's more what we can agree upon as, oh, yeah, I connect with that, rather than, oh, he got shot, she got shot.
Colin Fleming talking about films of 1954 and Inversions with us here on Downtown. Check out Colin's work at colinflemminglit.com. Thank you, my friend. Let's do it again next week.
Sounds good.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays here on Downtown.